Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After years of complaints about too much public school testing, a compromise bill cutting back on the testing tsunami is now moving through the Florida legislature.
Yes, it eliminates four end-of-course exams, civics, U.S. history, geometry, and algebra 2. These are the state-generated EOCs.
Also tonight, experts say teaching kids about money makes sense.
Students who come from states which require a course on financial literacy are more likely to save, more likely to invest, and less likely to incur risky financial debt.
We'll also hear about an even more serious shortage of healthcare providers looming for Florida's low-income patients and why a statewide fracking ban, once thought nearly a sure thing, is starting to fade away. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the start of week five of the Florida legislative session. This is Capitol Report. Right or left, Republican or Democrat, one thing most Florida parents, teachers, and school administrators have pretty much agreed on in recent years is that the state's public school system just has too much standardized testing. After a rough start, a Florida Senate education panel has managed to move a major testing bill forward. Lynn Hatter reports the proposal is a mix of two separate testing bills.
The Senate started out with two major testing bills, one by Republican Senator Anatary Flores, the other by Democratic Senator Bill Monford. Monford's bill had the backing of teachers, school districts, and even Republican leaders like Education Budget Chief David Simmons. But there can only be one bill.
Yes, it eliminates four end-of-course exams, civics, U.S. history, geometry, and algebra 2. These are the state-generated EOCs. And it also adds a sentence that says that a student must take one statewide standardized mathematics assessment in high school that shall be Algebra 1, Geometry, or Algebra 2, all for the purpose of assuring that if someone does take Algebra 1 in middle school, that still there would be the assurance of compliance with the Every Student Succeeds Act.
That's Simmons reading off an amendment. It's a tweaked version of language that comes straight from Monford's bill, which he introduced last month.
The bill makes several common sense changes to our system. A number of state-mandated end-of-course exams are eliminated, including Geometry, Algebra 2, U.S. History, and Civics.
Simmons's amendment allows the state to use at least one of those EOCs to comply with federal law. Monford's measure also lets students use a paper and pencil option to take state tests and gets rid of the controversial value-added model, a formula based on state test results that's used to evaluate teachers. All of those ideas are now part of Flores's bill through a series of amendments approved Monday in the Senate Education Committee. But parts of Flores's original proposal do remain.
We're at April 1st and school will still continue for a couple, for several more weeks. And so we'd like to move the testing window back. Also, we will say that the information that is given as far as what are the results of the statewide exams will be given to parents in an easy to read format, and also will be given to teachers in their, not just current teachers, but also the future teacher, so that the teacher that will be teaching the kid after they took the assessment, that teacher is armed with information of how the student did the previous year.
Flores's bill was held up in committee last week over Senator Tom Lee's concern that Monford's proposal was being taken away. The merged bill is now on a fast track in the Senate, but while that chamber is proposing a testing reduction, the House companion bill does not include any of the new amendments. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Len Hatter.
But if there's been a near universal consensus that Florida kids are tested too much, there's also been a growing admission that there are some crucial life skills that public school kids should know that they're not being taught. Roth IRAs, pensions, investments, money markets, credit scores, personal finance can be difficult to navigate. Regan McCarthy reports now Florida lawmakers want to help.
You may not use much of that German you took in high school, or perhaps not even that U.S. history, but lawmakers are pushing a class Fort Myers Republican Representative Heather Fitzenhagen says most people will use.
This bill essentially is readiness for life. That's what this bill is all about. It's to make sure that once we have expended all of our efforts to make sure that our kids have been ready for school, gone through school, that they then have the tools that they need to be able to be successful in life.
Fitzenhagen is behind a bill that would require students to take a personal finance class in order to graduate from high school. Mark Anderson is from the Florida Council on Economic Education. He says teaching students how to understand their finances is a pivotal part of preparing them to start their jobs.
Students who come from states which require a course on financial literacy are more likely to save, more likely to invest, and less likely to incur risky financial debt than students who come from states which do not require a financial literacy course.
St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Wingay Newton says kids often follow the example set by their parents. And he says he knows from experience that example is not always the best practice.
Myself, when I started working at 16, got my little work permit, my mom had a Winn-Dixie check cashing card, so I went and got a Winn-Dixie check cashing card. You do what you're taught, and that's all I knew.
Joe Calhoun is the director of the Florida State University Gus Stravos Center for the Advancement of Free Enterprise and Economic Education. He says among U.S. adults, the level of financial illiteracy is, in his words, astounding. And he says that creates a vicious cycle. He gives the example of the many adults who are not adequately prepared for retirement.
A lot of that is not necessarily their fault. They were not taught at a young age. Their parents were not equipped to pass along that information.
And lawmakers say that lack of knowledge is also impacting college students. Members on another House panel discussed a measure to ensure college students know what they're getting into when they take out student loans. Republican Representative Tom Leake is pushing a bill that would require colleges and universities to give students a better idea of what it will take to pay off the student loans they're taking out.
My vision is that there would be one-on-one counseling with a student at the same time that you provide the counseling on how to get the money to pay tuition.
The bill requires colleges and universities to provide information about how much interest the student is likely to pay and what a student's monthly payments are likely to be. Both measures passed their committees Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
In Washington today, the U.S. Supreme Court turned down a request by Attorney General Pam Bondi's office to take up a dispute about the constitutionality of a Florida law that has barred merchants from imposing surcharges on customers who pay with credit cards. Bondi's office last year asked the High Court to decide the issue after a federal appeals court ruled that the law violated the First Amendment. The 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta said the law allows businesses to offer discounts to customers who pay with cash, but does not allow surcharges for credit card purchases, a situation the ruling likened to distinction in search of a difference. In its words, the Supreme Court today, as is common, did not explain its reasons for declining to hear the case. The challenge was filed in 2014 by businesses that had received cease and desist letters from the state related to alleged violations of the credit card surcharge law, according to court documents. The businesses were Dana's Railroad Supply in Spring Hill, TM Jewelry LLC in Key West, Tallahassee Discount Furniture in Tallahassee, and Cook's Sportland in Venice. The Florida case was similar to a dispute about a New York law that drew a ruling last week from the Supreme Court, and in that case, the Supremes ruled that a New York law about credit card surcharges involved regulating speech, but sent the case back to an appeals court for further consideration about whether the law violates the First Amendment. Still to come on Capitol Report, fewer health care dollars could mean fewer doctors and less care for Florida's disadvantaged patients. That's prompted an urgent meeting today between Governor Scott and safety net providers.
We could really see it as it's an increase. So that, yeah, that's the way that the math works. Ready? I'm going to blow your mind here. Are you ready?
A Florida fracking ban almost looked like a sure thing a few weeks ago. Not so much now, but ban supporters aren't giving up.
Oh, absolutely not. Now's not the time to throw in the towel. Now's the time to ramp it up.
Lawmakers hope new regulations will slow down the sale of invasive animals.
This will essentially hinder them from perhaps selling these invasive species.
And advocates are weighing in on the importance of a bill adding the dangers of human trafficking to Florida school curriculums.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Governor Rick Scott met today with members of the Safety Net Alliance of Florida to discuss hospital funding. Hospitals say doctors will leave the state and the poor may not get care if proposed budget cuts become permanent. Sarah Mueller has the latest on that.
State legislators are proposing cutting supplemental hospital payments and Medicaid funding. Safety Net hospitals provide almost half of the state's Medicaid and charity care. So the cuts worry Tony Cavallo of the Safety Net Alliance of Florida. He says the state is giving up a lot of federal funding.
The legislature, our governor, has taken positions that Florida is not getting its fair share of federal dollars, particularly in the supplemental payment area. And it seems a contradiction in terms, or certainly in our objective, to be forfeiting hundreds of millions of dollars of federal monies for a very small savings in the general revenue fund.
About a third of Floridians are on Medicaid or uninsured. Hospitals say they are currently giving away $4.6 billion in Medicaid services a year. They are reimbursed 72 cents for every dollar. They say under the governor and proposed House and Senate budgets, the reimbursement rate could fall to 58 cents. Governor Rick Scott has proposed cutting nearly $1 billion in Medicaid funding. The House and Senate are also proposing cuts. The House is considering slashing the rate for hospital inpatient Medicaid services by 7% and cutting supplemental payments. That may mean hospitals lose more than $600 million in state and federal funding next year. The Senate isn't proposing a rate reduction, but it is considering reducing Medicaid supplemental payments by more than $200 million with a federal match. Senate Health Appropriations Chair Anna Terry Flores says hospitals will come out ahead because of a low-income pool of funding known as LIP. LIP is made up of local government and federal matching dollars to cover the expenses of hospitals who care for the uninsured.
We could really see it as it's an increase. So that, yeah, that's the way that the math works. Ready? I'm going to blow your mind here. Are you ready?
Tony Carvalho of the Safety Net Alliance says he hopes Flores is predicting the future. He says the state is discussing full LIP funding with the federal government in hopes the federal government will restore the dollars.
She may know something I don't know, but I don't think the decision has been inked yet. I think they're still working and negotiating on the level and the terms of the low-income pool.
But Carvalho and others warn that doctor shortages in Florida will worsen if these cuts go through. The 14 public, teaching, and children's hospitals make up the majority of doctor residency positions. Florida is already short psychiatrists, primary care physicians, and surgeons. Leon Haley is dean of the University of Florida College of Medicine in Jacksonville. He says they are graduating more people than there are residency slots in the state.
Frankly, it makes little fiscal sense for Florida to invest in teaching students in medical schools without simultaneously investing in the requisite number of residency spots. To do so is to effectively spend taxpayer money to educate other states' doctors.
Hospitals had 313 new residency slots this year, but Safety Net hospitals say those positions, funded under a program created 2 years ago, are being undermined by the proposed cuts. They say they may scale back residency programs and other services. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
When the session began, opponents of hydraulic fracturing were smelling victory, with Republicans in both chambers pushing a statewide ban. But as the halfway point nears, the ban is stalled. The only fracking bill with any momentum would allow utilities to invest in the controversial drilling method. Jim Ash has more.
Republican Senator Dana Young and her environmental allies were all smiles after her statewide ban cleared its first committee. She seemed surprised when reporters pointed out that it was the first day of session.
Obviously, I didn't do that as setting a statement, but I am thrilled that it did, and hopefully we will have all the time we need to get it through both houses.
Senate Pro Tem Anna Terry Flores of Miami had already sent hope soaring with a promise not to cut deals on an issue as important as fracking in Florida. While industry experts claim the controversial method can be done safely, critics say it's too risky in Florida, where the bedrock is porous limestone and drinking water comes from underground aquifers.
This is a bit of a black and white issue, and so I don't really see a majority of the Senate moving backwards from anything beyond a ban.
But as the halfway point of the session approaches, reality appears to be sinking in. Young's bill has ample co-sponsors, but it has yet to clear its second committee. And the House companion is bottled up. House sponsor Mike Miller, an Orlando Republican, is reciting a familiar refrain, maybe next year. Fracking opponents like Rethink Energy President Kim Ross are suddenly on the defensive.
Certainly not ready to declare it over. It is actually up to Speaker Corcoran as to whether or not the bill will move forward in the House. And so we're still calling on Speaker Corcoran to listen to the people.
More than 80 cities and counties in Florida have passed anti-fracking ordinances or resolutions. If Corcoran wants to keep his promise to represent the will of the people, he'll let the bill move, Ross says. Meanwhile, Rethink Energy protesters are headed to Fleming Island to remind Republican Senator Rob Bradley to schedule a vote on Young's bill in his committee. Florida Conservation Voters Executive Director Aliki Moncrief refuses to go away quietly.
Oh, absolutely not. Now is not the time to throw in the towel. Now is the time to ramp it up.
But at the same time, Moncrief admits she's already looking ahead to next year.
Regardless of what's happening on the House and the roadblocks that Representative Miller is unfortunately facing, there's still a huge opportunity to pass this on the Senate side.
It's extremely rare for the legislature to sign off on a bill that hasn't been heard in committees in both chambers. Senate passage would at least increase the bill's chances for next year, Moncrief says. Meanwhile, the House wants to give the Public Service Commission the authority to allow monopoly utilities to invest directly in oil and gas production, including fracking. Republican Jason Broder of Sanford told a House panel the move would protect against wild swings in natural gas prices, which have zoomed from $2 a BTU, or British thermal unit, to as much as $16.
So an 800% fluctuation means that there's an awful lot of risk involved with acquiring that product. Physical hedging can protect against market volatility, which is often driven by the conditions that can't be controlled.
The bill would be limited to utilities like Florida Power and Light that generate at least 65% of their electricity with natural gas. FPNL Vice President Sam Forrest insists it's the best way to give the utility some control over a $3.6 billion fuel tab. But Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's Susan Glickman says allowing utilities to charge ratepayers for the investment would set Florida apart from any other state. Glickman argued it's not right to ask customers to gamble on fracking when wind and solar is the wave of the future.
They're going to be charging, you know, ratepayers for decades. This is not something you want to put a bet on now while the world is changing.
Republicans are pushing the bill after the Florida Supreme Court ruled the PSC does not have the power to allow utilities to invest in drilling operations. The bill squeaked by the House panel 9-6. Unlike the fracking ban, the utility bill is being fast-tracked in the Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
The Florida House has okayed a bill to limit the sales of non-native animals by pet dealers. Catherine Buckler reports the bill hopes to discourage non-native sales altogether.
The bill got unanimous approval in a House subcommittee. It is aimed toward reducing the negative ecological impact of non-native animals, including the tegu lizard, the lionfish, and non-native lizards and snakes. In order to sell the animals, retailers will be required to perform certain tasks to help track the non-native animals. Republican Representative Halsey Bashirs hopes the bill will reduce sales.
The problem is with lionfish, and this is really, it's difficult to do, is you're going to have to tag them. This will essentially hinder them from perhaps selling these invasive species.
Bashirs says the bill is inclusive of non-native animal species.
If you look here, we're addressing all the lionfish. That's what it is. So you show the genus here, as well as the tegu lizard. They list all those species that specifically it's targeting.
Republican Senator Frank Artiles is pushing a similar bill in the Senate. The measure creates a pilot program through the Florida Wildlife Commission to control the sale of non-native animals by pet dealers. Artiles has participated in python hunts and speaks from experience on the damage of non-native species.
We've seen barely a dent made, but we need the help of the U.S. Wildlife, Fish and Wildlife, to fund these type of invasive species hunting for on a year-round basis, especially in the federal parks. So what we have right now in the Everglades is that little furry creatures have been decimated by the python.
According to Artiles, the U.S. loses $120 billion in damages due to non-native species each year. Both the House and Senate bill limit dealers to selling 20 animals a year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Catherine Buckler.
The states of Florida and Georgia will split nearly $51,000 in additional fees for Special Master Ralph Lancaster. Back in February, he sided with Georgia in a long-running legal battle about water use in the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River system. The Supreme Court today ordered that the state split that money for Lancaster's work between January 1st and February 28th. That followed a similar order in February in which the Supreme Court ordered the states to split a $213,000 tab for Lancaster's work between September 1st and December 31st. Florida filed a lawsuit back in 2013 alleging that Georgia is using too much water from the river system and is damaging Apalachicola Bay in Franklin County. Lancaster in February recommended to the Supreme Court that Florida be denied relief, dealing a major blow to the state's case. The Supreme Court on March 20th said more legal briefs will be filed in the case that will allow Florida to contest Lancaster's recommendation. Costs of the litigation has drawn scrutiny from Florida House leaders as the state has spent tens of millions of dollars on legal fees. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, we began this evening's Capitol Report with some stories about reducing testing while expanding the curriculum in the state's public schools. We end tonight's program with yet another subject that could be added to the compulsory list. A bill requiring Florida schools to teach about the dangers of human trafficking is starting to advance in the Senate, as we hear from Sasha Cordner.
Currently, middle and high schools are required to at least teach U.S. history, Florida's history, and government. It also mandates the history of the Holocaust, African Americans, and health education. And Senator Greg Stubbe's bill would add an additional requirement, the dangers of human trafficking. A Sarasota Republican says the idea came directly from a Riverview High School senior in his district.
I've been doing this for 7 years. It's not too often this process where you actually have a high school student in your district come to you about an issue. When she came to me, she had already drafted the legislation. I looked through it and I thought, you know, this is something that is really needed in our school system today.
That high school student is Natalie McCare King. She says she first came up with the idea while she was attending a leadership program called Girl State. She says she hadn't intended to present the bill to Stubbe until she started talking to kids at her school about human trafficking.
And something that really almost scared me was that no one had any idea. When I talked to teachers, they didn't know that human trafficking was an issue, especially in Sarasota, Florida, a very affluent, nice neighborhood. They didn't understand that this is a real issue and it's happening in our backyard.
So what does King's proposal include?
In our already existing health classes in high schools, we would have a section that would talk about human trafficking, different dangers and signs that you can recognize it. There are pretty recognizable patterns that go on that traffickers use to get to different students. A lot of it is online, and so we preach internet safety, but the students don't realize why that is, and they don't realize the tactics that different traffickers are using.
King adds the curriculum would also include what students can do to help, like calling the National Human Trafficking Hotline. Florida ranks third in the nation in calls to the hotline.
They give us all little cards that have hotline numbers on them, but what they don't explain is who's going to pick up the phone? What's the process going to be when we do call, when we ask for help? What's going to happen to us?
And King says it's really needed so students can recognize the signs and dangers.
Many of the runaways are approached by traffickers. It's no longer just the typical male, or it's no longer just women being targeted. It's young boys, and it's couples that are doing this. And so students just really need to be aware of this issue so that they can keep themselves safe. And it's not to scare them into doing anything, but it's really to help them to keep themselves safe.
Barbara Devane, representing the Florida chapter of the National Organization for Women, says as a former educator, this bill will help protect the state's youth as well as build on ongoing anti-trafficking efforts.
While improved prosecution of traffickers and better services for victims are vital, equally important is greater awareness and education. And no one needs that education more than our youth. The average age of trafficking victims is in the 11 to 14 year range. Last year, DCF reported a 54% increase in the number of human trafficking reports to the hotline over the previous year. This constituted almost 1,900 reports of human trafficking of children in Florida in 2015-16.
Stubbe's bill also allows students to opt out of learning about human trafficking if they get a note from their parent. While his bill recently passed its first Senate committee, the House measure has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank Catherine Buckler and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report and join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.